Welcome to this week's Casterbris Podcast with a K, available on Casterbris, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Casterbris Podcast with a K. My name is Christian Corley. With me, as ever, is super posh boy James McLean. How are you, James?
I'm feeling particularly super posh today.
Excellent. And from the United States of America, from some inconsequential part of the union whose name escapes me at the moment, it's Brian Terranova.
It's not a very important name anyway.
Okay. Is it consequential, though?
It is very consequential, isn't it, your state?
I suppose that it is, yes.
Well, that founding father bits.
Is it? Oh, is it? Oh,
Liberty
is it,
Bell and right, all yeah. that stuff.
It's that one, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is that one.
Okay.
You got it, yeah.
Are you proud with me for knowing that stuff?
I am, yeah. I'm very proud of you.
Oh, I'm quite proud of me too.
How do you know that stuff, James?
Oh, I've got this big blackboard in the dining room here, and I've got the butler, and he's actually writing notes from one of the encyclopedias on it, giving me little handy hints on how to get on with people, how to make friends and influence people, or as I call it, how to tolerate idiots and make them feel slightly welcome.
Okay. His research isn't very good for me.
No, it doesn't, does it? No, yeah, I know you didn't write that on the blackboard, but fine, you know, I've got to improv a little.
Okay. So, yes, it's Doctor Who talking time with loads of other nonsense that we normally bring into things. And did I ask Brian how he was, by the way?
He's good.
Is he good?
You didn't ask him, but he's good.
He is good.
Yeah.
That is good. That's good too.
He'd like to know how you are this week, though. I don't know why, but he's asking me to ask you. So. See,
Brian's asking you. Well, who are you?
Brian's representative.
Well, there's two Brians, isn't there? So it could be one or the other.
Oh, well, we got right. Terran Evil on the show. We should do that sometime, Terran Evil.
It's quite possible.
We should, definitely. Yeah. Oh, he's drawing a penis on the blackboard. Oh, no, it's a Dalek.
He's easily mistaken. Okay, so, well, I'm very well, thank you, Brians. And it's very, very kind of you to ask.
He's drawing a penis. Oh, no, it's Alpha Centauri. No, carry on.
Okay, there's been some Doctor Who news in the past week. On the whole, it is, I wouldn't say it's boring, it's pedestrian. There's nothing, you know, we're in a limbo between series, and we're in that kind of spoilery limbo zone now, where they're recording the finale and some of the later episodes, and, you know, talking about those things kind of upsets people a bit. So we're not going to be talking about shrunken TARDISes at all this week.
Whoops.
Oh, dear.
Apocalypse. So, yeah. Sadly.
Oh, he's drawing a penis. No, it's a tissue compression eliminator. Sorry, carry on.
Okay. There's absolutely no reason for me to mention Rick Mail, but I'm going to anyway. Because I'm really, I'm still quite upset by that. And the fact that one of the, if not the greatest comedy talents of his generation, has passed away. You know how people used to say that of people like Eric Morgan and Tommy Cooper, I'm specifically talking to James here, that he'd come on stage and you'd just laugh at him. Anyone have to say anything? You'd just laugh at him. There's no one like that now. And I think that's bollocks, because Rick Mail certainly had that quality about him, and I think Rowan Atkinson does as well.
Yeah, I think it's bollocks, because neither Eric Morecambe or Tommy Cooper are that funny. So, you know, if you're laughing at them, then you're an idiot as well. So, I know. I mean, I to be fair, I like Eric Morecambe. I liked Eric Morecambe, Tommy Cooper. Yeah, my dad quite liked him, despite but they weren't my generation, you know.
Yeah.
Rick Mail sort of spoke to me as a 7-year-old, as he speaks to me now as a 13-year-old, whatever I am, age-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
There was something about the humour and the breakdown of alternative comedy that he represented, which just touched and informed in a way that Tommy Cooper and Eric Morecambe wouldn't with a kid. And I think that's what kind of made the alternate block and Rick Mail so powerful, was that he actually touched and in sort of infused humour into kids as much as he was doing to adults.
Yeah,
he was sort of very broad.
He was suggested for Doctor Who in the press some years ago.
Was he?
Yeah. Would you? I mean, do you think he could? I'm not going to ask Brian about this. I don't think Brian's familiar with Rick Mayall, unless he's seen Drop Dead Fred.
Yeah, I was going to say I am familiar with him.
Blackadder.
I knew his Blackadder work, his okay. Drop Dead Fred, and there were a couple other things. But I will say, at the same time, it was only a couple of years ago that I realized they were the same person because he's so different in them.
Yeah, yes. It was a really, like, really good comedy actor.
I would have never put Blackadder and Drop Dead Fred together, you know?
Yeah, he was really good comedy. In fact, you know, I wrote an article on Cult Britannia about Rick Mayall passing on, and I put in the two Lord Flashouts. I completely forgot about Mad Gerald from the last episode of The Blackadder.
Mm-hmm.
When Blackadder's incarcerated with him and he wants a key, and he's got a key made out of his own teeth. And so Blackadder legs it, and then you just hear, "Shut the bloody door!"
But I mean, he did other guys, I mean, like the New Statesman as well, with Troughton, with Michael Troughton.
Michael Troughton, yeah.
So there's our Doctor Who link, which he was very good in that.
Well,
he was
Christopher Ryan, the Sontaran as well, from the young ones. He's always,
yes, absolutely. Rick Mayall was a great influence of me as a kid. I even had a rat's tail as a kid for a little bit, which
did
I don't tell people. Yeah,
I've just had my haircut this afternoon. I've gone from kind of having a very kind of maybe slightly bohemian writer-esque floppy fringe to having a very short back and sides. And there was this midpoint where when they did the number one above the ears, and I had this slight Rick look about me.
Mm.
With that face close shaved over his ears. So, Rick Mayall, that's a bit of sad news, and not directly related to Doctor Who, but he's nevertheless...
British institution.
British institutional type things, yes, indeed. Now, we've had our long-form articles are going very well on Casterbris. We have had a really good interview with Scott Hancock about the new Bernie Summerfield series from Big Finish, which is coming along soon. So if you haven't seen that already, do please check that out. Apparently, it does seem that the Doctor and Ace aren't in all of them, just in one or two. So that's quite interesting, because I did get the impression they were in all of them. And we've also had Why There Is Something Inherently Wrong with Torchwood by writer Andy Frankham Allen, which I was very, very pleased to hear from him when he suggested writing this. So... Why There Is Something Inherently Wrong with Torchwood basically gets to the nitty-gritty that it's completely unsuitable for children, and there are various other elements of it that don't work, but the fact that children will want to watch Torchwood. And that's kind of the... because of Jack and because of Martha in Series 2 and because of its relation with Doctor Who. Because of things like Journey's End.
Yeah.
There has been considerable discussion, 107 comments so far by Monday afternoon, which is when we're chatting, dear Casterbrides. I know kind of how James views this because I've read his comments, so we'll come to James second. Brian, Torchwood, Doctor Who. Do you think there's something, do you think there's anything inherently wrong with Torchwood, first of all, Brian?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've thought that for a while. It's not that it's a bad show, mm-hmm. It's just that I felt that they never really found their footing. And kind of when they did with Children of Earth, they lost it again very quickly with Miracle Day. But I've said for a while now that one of the biggest mistakes that they made in my eyes was in season two, their episode Sleeper.
Yeah.
They had a great, fantastic base for their own kind of recurring villains, their own kind of theme, their own kind of quest within the show, which was to stop these sleeper agents mm-hmm. that are just randomly popping up and trying to take over us, and how you could build and expand on that idea. And they did it for one episode, but it seemed like such a perfect idea for a team that was based here on Earth to have dealt with. But I mean, in keeping with what the article was talking about, I do agree. You know, Torchwood kind of bounced with every episode. It bounced from trying to be a little Doctor Who, a little too adult, a little too trying to break the mold of what the Doctor Who fans were used to. And I think that you were always going to have that problem, kids aside, of people who loved Doctor Who trying to watch Torchwood and just getting an expansion on a show that they love. And it was even going to be too vastly different for them. And I've said the same thing when it comes to terms for the Sarah Jane Adventures. you know, the Doctor Who series was always written as a family series. It was supposed to appeal from children up to adults. So when you bring in the Sarah Jane Adventures, you didn't have to dumb it down for children because children were already smart enough to be watching Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. And the same thing applies to Torchwood. You didn't have to try and make it more sexy or more adult. And they didn't even try to make it sexy. They didn't even try to make it like just have a little bit of that hint of sex appeal that makes you kind of gravitate a little bit more towards it. They tried to downright make it be an adult show, you know, proper triple X kind of adult show. And it was wrong. It just didn't work. Great themes, great characters and great ideas, but unfortunately all handled poorly.
Yeah. I mean, we have mentioned Torchwood in the past on the modern podcast, as it was, although I think it might have been a while ago. Now, I've long felt that Torchwood wasn't adult. I've long thought it was adult for teenagers. And, you know, there are other shows that have come along since Torchwood. I think Torchwood's been quite influential in sci-fi in the UK, certainly, in setting a particular tone. But it's not adult. Waters of Mars is adult, I think. That's Doctor Who doing mature drama. There's one or two other examples, Midnight, for instance. But Torchwood isn't doing Torchwood's silly in many ways, isn't it? What are you going to say, James?
Let's play devil's advocate here.
Okay, then
I mean, you could argue that things like the Young Ones is adult humour.
Mm-hmm. But we're talking about humour.
Yeah, no, but it's still not what people would consider mature or adult.
Well, I wouldn't consider Torchwood to be mature.
But this is my point.
Okay,
is that people are confusing, or no? I think we're all in a danger of a sort of slightly snobbish tyrism here. That Torchwood does contain adult themes. They're just adult themes that are either considered fairly superficial or fairly base, and thus they don't quantify to what people want. But they are still adult themes, and in the same way that The Young Ones is fun adult humour with very, very little subtext or clever elements to it beyond its mandate and its bravado, doesn't mean that it's a lesser show for it. Now, I agree to a large extent, as we've talked about this many times before, especially when Miracle Day was airing. Mm. So we've all talked about Torchwood. None of us are impressed with it as a general thing. But I think there is a danger of sort of getting a little snarky on it and the fact that it's the wrong type of adult, but it's still quantified as adult nonetheless. And as Gareth said in the comments, Gareth Cavanagh, and I thought it was a beautifully written post, and if you've not read it, I really think you should, because I think it's a great counter to a very interesting article. You know, he points out, firstly, that it was a sanitized version did go out for kids. There was an edited cut that would go out so kids could see it. Mm-hmm. And secondly, as this is what we both were saying, is that it was made for BBC Three, which at the time was not really commissioning for highbrow, intelligent, mature drama. It was aimed at a sort of young adult, late teen market who were very much interested in relationships, going out on the raz and sex and vices. And that's what the show is aimed at. The problem with Torchwood is that it was too many things and it couldn't be any of them. So while it was doing that, clearly they had a remit through Doctor Who, whether they liked it or not. And it was one that obviously Davis responded to that it could be broken down to appeal to kids, which is why I think you have the stupid hub Batcave and the Batmobile. So kids would enjoy that bit. You've got this silliness, you know, superficial adults to cater to the channel that it's being aired on. And then at the same time, there's an expectation for it to be giving something a little more for adults. And it tries occasionally, but it can't because it's just not the right format. So it becomes a mishmash of no direction. And I think there's a good point that Brian made sort of, I don't know, intentionally or inadvertently, is that, you know, people have a go at Torchwood for being misdirective of the family audience. But then you could also argue the same for the Sarah Jane Adventures. Mm. Because, I mean, if Doctor Who is for family, Sarah Jane Adventures, let's face it, is dumbed down for kids in the sense that while the stories are very Doctor Who-ish, there is no way that you could argue that Sarah Jane Smith would take children out to battle vicious, deadly aliens, apart from the fact that it's a remit for a children's show. So you want to have kids in it. And so you've got to look past that. But it bastardizes Doctor Who to a certain degree. But you'll get a lot less people saying that than they will against Torchwood, because Torchwood just generally didn't work. Well, Sarah Jane Adventures had a charm to it. And I think that's why a lot of people are a lot more kind to Sarah Jane Adventures, even though it does the same thing as Torchwood. But there you go. So I've written a couple of posts on this. That's why I'm so charged with ideas on it.
No, that's quite fine. Well, let's take an episode of Torchwood. Oh,
yes, please.
And, you know, and the first thing, I'm just scrolling through the article now, and the first thing that pops up is the Cyberwoman. And I think, is that really the episode of Torchwood that we really want to talk about?
Well, I actually like Cyberwoman, apart from the stupid cyber costume. I think it's actually quite a tense bit of drama.
I was just going to say the same thing there. I think the episode actually works well. I think the issue that they did falls under that adult thing again. And when I say adult, I'm thinking more of X-rated adult, unfortunately, because that's what they were trying for. They made the Cyberwoman. They tried to make her this sexy cyber thing, you know, this sexy lingerie version of a cyber suit, rather than going a bit more adult with the show, like they should have done in the proper term of the adult, and show us what a half cybernetic person actually looks
like.
Well,
yeah, I was exactly what I was going to say, because remember when I went to, and I mentioned this in the Costobus magazine too, and I've definitely mentioned it on the podcast, when I went to Sumo Digital Studios back in 2010, they had designs up for different Cybermen for the second installment of the adventure games. And one of them was quite horrific. It was cyborg human cadaver. They didn't use it in the game, sadly, because obviously the game was for a family audience. But it was absolutely horrific in terms of what we've seen of Cybermen, certainly since the 1960s. It was on a par with being converted into a Dalek in 1985.
I mean, I think the problem with...
And they should have used something like that.
With Cyberwoman is probably a problem with Series 1 of Torchwood, which, to be fair, is what Series 1 of Doctor Who under Davis had as well. Is that it was in fairly unknown territory. So you could almost forgive them and say, well, fine, they weren't quite sure who was going to hook onto this. They weren't quite sure whether they would even hook the BBC Three audience. So you can almost forgive them for the rather lame and slightly lazy and obviously slightly exploitive approach to the visuals in Cyberwoman. But you get to Series 2, where they should have learned from their mistakes from Series 1 and found their niche, it doesn't really feel that much different.
Bloody Torchwood.
Apart from the fact that it's borrowing more from Buffy than ever, it feels almost, to me, Series 2 almost feels less confident than Series 1. The ideas seem to be more borrowed. They seem less... It doesn't hang together as well.
Well, Series 1 of Doctor Who, the only thing that is that doesn't work as it should, and this can only be down to design and direction, is the first two-parter, the Slitheen story. The rest of the... to be honest with you, I've watched it again since, and I love it. I can get... You know, some of it's not perfect. There's a little bit too much farting, but it's a good, solid story, and it does a job of introducing things into what's going to follow on as the rest of the series. And, you know, the rest of the series is excellent. It's only that one that possibly is just a bit of a misfire.
The only thing with that story, I agree with what you just said there. I do. I think the only thing that they should have done with that story was not make the aliens enjoy the fact that they were farting so much and that they found it funny. Like when they first started, they actually had the and I forget his name, but the first living the prime minister type character, he had farted and the guy next to him just kind of looked at him and he seemed at first embarrassed by it. And I thought that was good. I thought that's okay. It's a bit silly. The kids are going to laugh at that thing, but this guy is trying to like clearly cover up. People are going to start figuring out something's wrong with me or think I'm sick and do something else, you know, and I like that direction, but then they started making them get too silly. And it was definitely
the wrong
direction for that.
Yeah,
for that show. Yeah, I mean, because it was otherwise it was a neat idea. I like the idea that they had a way that aliens could disguise themselves as humans, but there was some sort of tell that was really like non-complimentary. You know, I thought that was kind of interesting, you know, especially since you can misconstrue it as just somebody who's having a very upset tummy that day. You know, it was a neat idea. Just again, like you said, poor execution on it.
Yeah, but I suppose, again, to be fair, it was at a point in that first block where they weren't sure whether they were going to have to be targeting kids or whether they could rely on targeting adults as well. And I'm still sure that is the problem with those early episodes, is that they're throwing a few different styles out there to see what sticks because they don't know what's going to stick. And quite frankly, I don't blame them. I didn't know what was going to stick. I remember seeing the teaser, the industry teaser for Doctor Who, which was basically just the TARDIS dematerializing. And I saw that prop and I thought, my God, it looks so rubbish. This is going to look just terrible. So, you know, there's no confidence from me as a fan in whether they could actually pull off Doctor Who in this new era. So I can understand why there was some hit and misses.
But at the same time, they learned by their mistake fairly early on within that first season, because by the time we got to Boomtown, which was apparently an episode that wasn't even meant to be part of episode series one, he decided to correct his mistake with those aliens, and it worked really well.
Yeah.
And yet they couldn't do this with Torchwood. You know, they struggled very hard till they finally seemingly got it close to right with Children of Earth, which did still have some issues, naturally, but they did pretty well, and it seemed like things were going to start looking up. The show finally found its footing, but it took them three series to do so.
But again, Children of Earth was a remit for BBC One out on a late evening shot. So to be fair to Davis, again, I think a lot of the issues with Torchwood was where it was being aired. As soon as he takes it off BBC Three, puts it onto BBC One, which has got a totally different market base, suddenly, you know, the hub is destroyed, the Batmobile disappears. You've got a smaller collective cast. You've got a far darker, mature story. And I think a lot of Torchwood's problems is that it was marketed as an adult show, and people saw it as it meaning that would be mature, serious Doctor Who. But it was sold on BBC Three, which was there for teenagers and young adults. And so I think the sad thing is, if Torchwood had gone straight to BBC One, I think it would have probably been a very different show, and it would have been a far better show. I think, anyway, at the same time, there was a lot of things wrong. The casting, I think, was bad for Torchwood. I think while his character, he's a good character writer, Davis, the team, and maybe himself as well, had some characters which just didn't sit well. They were sort of sitting in a sort of mature, we have such a hard life, it's so terrible. Yet at the same time, it still had that flair of Davis's, isn't monsters and everything so exciting? And it just jarred. They just seemed morose and whiny. And, you know, having Jack morose for a series was a bad move as well. Mm. So it felt flat. It felt sexual in a way that you didn't want to see because you didn't like any of the characters. So seeing Owen jump from person to person, you know, didn't make me warm to a character who wasn't actually, no offense to the actor, he wasn't a particularly warm character in the first place. So there's just so many issues with Torchwood, I think. But I do feel that the fact that it was slightly adult in the wrong way isn't the problem. I think the problem with Torchwood is it just didn't hold together. Because otherwise, it could have been like Buffy. Because Buffy was the same target audience, pretty much. And it had, as we know, Torchwood went down and sort of borrowed a hell of a lot of Buffy storylines, from the angel thing with Jack to James Masters coming in and playing an identical person as Spike, to even an episode where one of the characters made all the others believe that he was part of the team, which was exactly taken off Buffy. There's loads of Buffy stuff in there. And that's before you get to Davis's love of that sort of dialogue. But it wasn't Buffy. So I think the problem with Torchwood isn't the adult content. I don't think it's the problem. I know, going back to the original authors, I don't think the issue is with children as well. If it's not meant for children, they shouldn't see it. I think there's a certain tough titty involved there. I think as soon as a family show like Doctor Who can't expand and try different things because kids might try and watch the wrong thing, I don't know. That to me seems counterproductive. I think the issue with Torchwood is that it just wasn't good enough.
At the same time with that, though, whenever you try and do a spin-off from something that is massively popular, you want to try and appeal to the audience that's already there and drag them into something else and have a built-in audience already for your show. So trying to discount some of your audience, the children, that would have been a bad idea, a bad start in the first place. Because they're the kids, generally. Like, if you're not getting the adults as much as you want and you are getting the kids, they're the people you're going to want. Because if you get the kids, you're going to get the parents with them as well. You know, just by the nature of, you know, they will sit there and watch it with them. Or if there's a movie, take them for that. Or buy the toys or whatever, you know. So, I mean, I get what you're saying there. But at the same time, trying to do a spin-off TV show from one to another and go for an entirely different audience was probably not the wisest move in the beginning.
But you say that, but then Children of Earth, which predominantly its audience would not be the BBC Three ones, judging by the ratings, it didn't at all and was horrendously successful.
But at that point, though, they had already gone down their road. That was essentially salvage the show any way that they could. Like, you're not trying to now, like, appeal to the base audience, the original audience. You're just trying to make a good story with this show and salvage a show. And they did successfully salvage the show at that point and then tanked it afterward. Like, if they went from Doctor Who and spun off with this new Torchwood series and it was Children of Earth, I still think it probably would have been the wrong direction because it would have been too heavy.
But isn't that what people wanted, though? Wasn't Children of Earth exactly what the Doctor Who fans were looking for when Torchwood was announced. Judging from the comments, that was what they were looking for, not what they got. That was what people wanted.
I thought, honestly, when Torchwood was announced, I was honestly hoping we were going to get something more like the fun TV show that Doctor Who was, but with a steady cast and Earth-based, kind of like the Pertwee era, but without the Doctor.
Right.
Is what I thought we were going to get. Like, and then when they started saying that it was going to be more adult, I started to get worried, just knowing what I already knew of Russell's writing from what had crept into Doctor Who and what he had done before. And I'll be honest, when it was announced that there was this other show, I was interested to watch it, but I was cautious because, you know, I wanted to watch more fun sci-fi shows, and I was concerned about the direction that they might go down. And when it did start, it wasn't a fun sci-fi show. It was a TV show that wanted to be a softcore porn show, you know, and it just didn't work.
With,
you know,
aliens.
I tried to enjoy, exactly, you know, and I tried to enjoy it for the characters and the science fiction aspects of it. And there were a few good stories in there. The other thing actually that had me concerned was when people did throw around the point that it was going to be a bit more Buffy-like, and that was mooted from the beginning because it had gotten out, or maybe even Russell had said it, and that worried me because I have watched every episode of Buffy because I had a girlfriend who was into the show. I hate that show. I hate it with a passion. I can't stand any episode of that show. Like, it was dread watching that show, and I was very terrified that Torchwood was going down that road, and I saw a lot of those things, certainly with the fish alien that was running around in the one episode and certain other character types and whatnot. But, you know, so I don't know. I do think the biggest failing of the show was not necessarily what audience it tried to throw itself at or what kind of TV show it aspired to be. It was that it never could, from one episode to the next, figure out what TV show it was. You know, they were just constantly, even within one episode, trying to do too much in two different realms that didn't mesh. They never found a link or a well-structured way to write an episode that made all of those things feel right. I mean, even to the end, even when you get to Miracle Day, and, you know, the entire world, and we've said this before in a podcast, so I won't dwell on it, but the entire world is doomed. And the only people who can save it is this, you know, band-aid together, Torchwood team. And the first thing that two of the members think to go do is go find someone to go have sex with. And really, like, that made no sense whatsoever, you know. And I understand he may have been trying to go for some kind of realism that, you know, people are facing these hardships in the best way they can. But, you know, it's a science fiction TV show. Like, come on. But really, was any of that necessary? It's what Torchwood did the entire way through. And if you're trying to fix the errors, you're failing. You're doing the wrong thing. You know, you're using the wrong patches.
There are various continuity issues between Torchwood and Doctor Who as well.
And within Doctor Who and Doctor Who.
Well, yes, we know that one, yeah. A lot of those. But, I mean, there's, I think someone pointed out in the comments, Children of Earth. No, Miracle Day.
Miracle Day.
In Miracle Day, Jack says he's 6 years old when he's not that old.
Well, yeah, I responded to that, and I said, I think personally, well, it could be two things. It could be the fact that we know that Russell Davies gets pressurized. We know that, you know, he's created quite a big convoluted universe. It could be very easy to make that mistake. Or simply, given that Miracle Day was hoping to sort of pilot a whole new load of stuff to the Americans, it could have been a way to sort of try and reestablish the basic concepts of Jack in a way that was detriment to continuity. But for the majority of the audience watching it in America, it would give them an easy way to sort of understand that Jack's meant to be a long-running character, hundreds of years old, a fixed point in time.
Sorry, what age did he say he was?
He says in Miracle, you know, when they go back, when you see the flashback to the 20s,
yeah.
I think it's the 20s, it was Prohibition, was it? And he sort of says to the boyfriend there that he's hundreds of years old and he's a fixed point in time. Now, he's not told he's a fixed point of time until he meets the Doctor in Utopia later on. And he's obviously only been, 50, 60 years, whatever it would be at that point. It was a bit of, retrospective writing, which is fair enough.
Yeah.
But then, as I've said before, you know, people get so... I watched Days of Future Past at the cinema this weekend, and, you know, with X-Men, and reading some of the conversations online about it, and people get so upset with the continuities, and, you know, that's a problem. And you think, well, if you've got a good story, it isn't a problem. If that line had appeared in Children of Earth, it wouldn't have bothered me, because Children of Earth was a good story. I could cope with a couple of gaffes. Mm. And the same with X-Men. I thought it was a really nicely run, fast-paced movie. It was good.
Well, I think
Miracle Day was a mess, and so these things become more irritating when it's a mess.
That is the thing with TV shows and movies nowadays, is that you know, the good old-fashioned suspension of disbelief just isn't a thing that the audiences have anymore, or even think that they should need to have anymore. Whereas, I agree. Like, there are certain things I can watch in a movie and just say, I can completely forgive that. Who cares about that tiny little thing? The story was just so good. It was enjoyable. Mistakes will happen. At the same time, I would appreciate, and when I say this, I don't mean that I feel that they need to, but I would appreciate when a writing team can catch mistakes like that. For instance, the birthday mistake for Rose in series one, and her missing flyers and all that stuff, like things like that. You have a TV show about time travel. You're within your first season. You think you could have caught something like that. You think that those are things you would have looked for to make your series be as tight as could be.
Do you want to just explain that for the listener?
There was the, you know, I don't remember it fully now, unfortunately, but they give her birthday, or they give her age on her missing flyer. And, you know, the missing flyer says she went missing in 2005, which means that she came back in 2006. But then in Father's Day, they give her birth date, which meant that her age would actually have been 1 year younger than it actually was, as posted in what was that one? Aliens of London.
Yeah.
So I don't remember the exact dates or the exact years, but and I think they also have Rose mention her age in The Unquiet Dead, which kind of confirms all of this. And they just got the math wrong. And
maybe
it was
there's a misprint
of a sad
on the flyer.
Error. Anything could have happened, but I think even the fact that she gave her age didn't gel with her birth date that was given in the Father's Day.
But if there's a year between, I mean, I know I tend to, I don't anymore for obvious reasons, but I used to always round up my age. People would say, you know, I would be 16. And people say, you know, my dad used to do it to me. So I used to, some people do round up or round down. I tend to try and round down now, obviously. But
the thing is, I'm not nitpicking this. This is the suspension of disbelief thing.
Yes.
And I'm saying,
yes.
Like, I can watch this and who cares? You know, they got that math wrong. But what I'm saying is that if some writer came along and were to write a science fiction time travel TV show like this, and they were able to get all those facts and figures worked out and mathematically work, I would really appreciate that somebody went that far with their story and what they did to try and make everything work out. And I think that's the thing that people have to remember is that while you would appreciate if somebody did get it right, it doesn't mean that these people aren't doing the show and they aren't trying just as hard as that person who may have gotten it right at some point. You know, they probably were, and things slipped through the cracks, and we have to forgive that sometimes. And I mean, suspension of disbelief starts with anything. It could be that incorrect date where you just say, okay, well, I'll just reconcile in my head what her proper age is. It doesn't matter that they've got it wrong there. Suspension of disbelief is also something like, well, you know, Indiana Jones could survive in that explosion hiding in a refrigerator. Even if you don't like that scene, that's the whole point of that scene, is that it was just meant to be silly fun, and your suspension of disbelief is supposed to kick in there. And that's the thing that a lot of audiences just don't have. So too many things that are okay in TV shows, or once upon a time were and still should be, just are not, because the audience is less forgiving these days for some reason. And maybe they feel that they're owed something for their viewership. I don't know. But it does tend to get very old, because I find myself defending a lot of really well-written stories for the dumbest things.
Well, I found this with the X-Men thing, is I went online and there was ones that said, you know, five big plot holes in X-Men Days of Future Present. And they weren't plot holes. They were, majority of them were things like, for instance, it didn't explain how from X-Men 3 Professor X comes back from the dead, how Wolverine has suddenly got metal claws in the future. These aren't plot holes. These are things that just aren't explained, but we have a nature in Western culture which we need it spoon-fed, and if it's not spoon-fed, we're like kings on a throne.
Whoa, hold on. Wolverine's got metal claws?
Yeah, but in Wolverine, the film, he loses them. He's left with bone claws again.
Oh, well, hold on. Oh, really? Oh, right, okay.
Well, you know, without crossing our topics here too much, the Wolverine has hits his bones, which bring the claws out. They are just laced with metal. Which is removed in Wolverine, but yet in X-Men.
When you say removed in Wolverine, do you mean Wolverine the first film or the Wolverine the second?
Wolverine the second film.
They're removed, forcibly removed.
Yes, they're chopped. His bone, his claws are cut off. They're chopped off, and because they regrow because it's bone, he just has bones again, which is a homage to the comic where I think it's happened like 15 times.
But
the point being is that these were just things that the movies didn't bridge the gap. But we do have this, as I say, this king mentality where we sit on our throne, and the jester, the entertainer, comes and entertains us. And if we don't feel we've been supplicated well enough, we get very cross. As I said, I think I've said this before, if you go to Eastern culture, if you look at Japanese films, I was watching 20th Century Boys the other day, which is an adaptation of a manga. And there's loads of things there which just aren't explained, but they don't have this mentality where they have to. Audiences sit back and go, right, that's either fine because it's not relevant to the plot, or fine, I'm enjoying this scene because it's cathartic rather than realistic. And they seem to be able to do that more, which we won't allow. You're not allowed to do that in American, in Western culture. You can't have cathartic scenes. So, for instance, it can be very exciting, can be very enjoyable to watch a hero sort of come back and down the bad guy in a way which feels utterly unrealistic. You wouldn't be able to do it at that point, but we let it go because we're enjoying that moment. While in the Western films, we will sort of say in television, he couldn't do that because he'd have just fallen through the roof of the building and he wouldn't be able to get up to face Rassilon. So that's ridiculous. So we can't suspend and sort of say, yeah, but what we're meant to do is we're meant to enjoy that pretty cool moment when he comes smashing through the ceiling and lands right in front of them and he's not sure whether he's going to be dead or not. We can't enjoy that because we're too busy fussing. And that's the very difference in our culture. And I think it's a shame because you do lose out on those little moments. There you go.
Okay.
And breathe.
We will leave Torchwood then for now. I dare say we'll come back to Torchwood in the future. We tend to, invariably. And we'll move on to missing episodes and classic episodes. And we're not specifically going to talk about any particular one series or serial, but we are going to talk about the idea that episodes might be colorized, or how we feel about them being colorized. I know there are some colorized episodes on the interwebnet on YouTube, largely courtesy of the same guy whose name escapes me at the moment.
The Babel
color dude. Yes.
Yeah.
He's not called Babel Fish. That's another show. Babel color. I mean, colorization has been around for a long time. I remember back in the 80s, my dad got very excited that A Wonderful Life had been colorized.
See, I stand on the other ground. I think a lot of them should be decolorized.
Hmm. How does that work then?
Well, it takes a story which suffers horrendously badly for special effects or backdrops.
Invasion of the Dinosaurs
is a brilliant example. You pull out the color, flattens the images, it makes the disparities far less painful, and you get a better story. I mean, that one's an obvious one because as you're pointing out, one episode was colorized.
Yeah.
And I think it was actually better in black and white.
It was,
Mind of Evil is another good example, I think, where the prison set looks so much better in black and white than when it's colorized.
It is funny that what you're saying there with the Invasion of Dinosaurs, because when they colorized that first episode, I remember actually being sad to not have a DVD with that episode in black and white. So I had a VHS copy and I had a digital copy of the episode, and I kept the digital episode of just the black and white one so I could sometimes watch it that way because it had such a great feel. It wasn't even just the colorizing of it. The sound mix was different. They cleaned up the sound a lot, and it kind of made the episode feel a bit more normal with the rest of them. But when you watch it in black and white, it had a nice quality feel to it.
Do you know? We're completely getting away from the point of what we were supposed to be speaking about. And apologies to Kelvin who suggested this, but actually, do you know what? I think there might be a very strong case for watching the entirety of season seven in black and white.
Right. Was that the original point?
That's my new point.
Okay.
John Pertwee's original run.
Yeah.
Just to see how atmospheric it be, and it was, you know, it's quite atmospheric to start with, but you know, get more. See if there's more of these Quatermass parallels when it's in black and white.
Well, not just those parallels, but you have just come from a black and white series with Patrick Troughton.
Well,
you
could indeed.
You could argue that having the first series of Pertwee in black and white creates a better mesh between the two eras for crossover before the Buffon appears. The Buffon years. I do like
Buffon
that.
Years. The John Buffon years.
But yeah, I mean, I'd like to see that. I mean, to be honest, it's kind of funny how digital technology is, because, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, if I had a DVD player, I could stick it in there, and obviously I'd have problems with the SCART lead and everything, but I could just turn the colour on my television down to zero, you know, nice and easy. I know you can do it, obviously, with your remote control, but it's a faff, isn't it?
Yeah.
On old sets, you could just turn it down by the dial.
And
you could watch with a knob. And you could, oh my God, he's drawn a Pete. No, it's a knob. And you could see it very easily, wouldn't you? We wouldn't have this argument. We could watch Series 7 and just turn down the colour on the television. I think it'd be great. I do genuinely feel that. I like watching old films and old sci-fi because of that, because I think the black and white creates such a wonderful texture, doesn't it? It's not just the fact that it hides mistakes. Even on stories where, you know, even Doctor Who stories, if we stay on the track of Doctor Who, where the sets aren't bad. I'm trying to think of ones any that spring to mind, to be honest, but I'm sure there are in William Hartnell's era take Seeds of Death, Patrick Troughton, where by and large, the sets are pretty solid. There's no need for backdrops. There's no massive special effects. You know, I think that carries a sort of a beauty to it in black and white, which I think it would lose in colour. So it's not just about hiding stuff. I think there is actually a feel, isn't there, to black and white?
Yeah, almost definitely. I'm just thinking there about modern Doctor Who and how that could benefit from just being viewed in black and white. And I'm thinking the Crimson Horror might be a good example because of its setting.
Yes, yes.
Except for the monster, and just have that in crimson.
In crimson, that's very arty, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think you might get a few complaints about that.
Sorry. Sorry, what were you going to say, Brian?
Oh, no, I mean, I had many thoughts out there. I'm trying to remember or trying to stay relevant with them, I guess. But you talked last week about watching some of those movies that I had made in 2004 that I just put up on Facebook.
But they weren't in black and white.
One of them was black and white.
Oh, was it?
Yes, the one where I was playing cards with myself. And when I was watching
that, and white?
I realized it was, yeah. And I realized to myself how much black and white can enhance a film, because that film, like just me playing cards by myself, it was a silly nothing idea, but for some reason the black and white quality made me feel very interested in it. And I, like James, I agree, I love watching old black and white movies. Sometimes I get in the mood for them. I'm a big fan of Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant, as well as Katharine Hepburn. Mm-hmm. And I love watching those movies from time to time, and you know, it made me think back to could you do a new series episode in black and white? And clearly the X-Files did it when they tried to tell like a Frankenstein's monster type movie. Mm-hmm. And it worked. And I think a Doctor Who story could go down that path and tell one. A new series Doctor Who story, excuse me, could go down that path and tell a black and white story and make it work and use it artistically for the means. And I think it enhances stories a lot. I think it really does help. And it's funny because when we started this conversation, I was going to say, much to the chagrin of most people, I think that I would actually like to see some of the classic stories colorized, but not colorized and then we never see the black and white versions. I would just like to see some colorized versions just out of interest, because when they colorized the Three Stooges movies, I originally thought, why the hell are they doing that? What's the point of that? And then I watched one and I saw how much more depth of field it gave the film. And it made me realize how much black and white film actually captures. You just can't see that depth of field because the color shades are all gray and white and black. And I found that very fascinating to watch, like how much more you could actually see and pay attention to in these episodes. And that's why I'd like to see it, just to see some of the things you may not pick up on or some of the things you may miss in black and white.
The colorized Metropolis is like that.
Is it?
The problem with Metropolis, though, is because it wasn't the correct edit. Was one of those ones because they lost Metropolis, didn't they? The proper edit of Metropolis they lost, and that only turned up in the last sort of 5-10 years or so. So when they did the colorized one, it was the wrong edit, so it was really unpopular. But it does have, there are points to it that you do have exactly what you're saying there.
Yeah, And the cool thing about those Stooges DVDs was, with the flick of a button on your remote, you could swap between black and white and color if you wanted to. So you got the black and white version. You have the original, so you have the purest form. But if you wanted a change, I think in some ways, when we watch these stories, sometimes we watch them so many times, we're not paying attention to them anymore because we know them. And I know certainly when I'm working on a prop or some kind of project, I'll put a story on as background noise. I've seen it a million times. I just want to hear it. But there were times, and there still are, where I watch a story and I pick up on things that I had not noticed before, either in the background or in the dialogue or whatever, because now I'm not trying to pay attention to the base story. I'm paying attention to anything that's new or new-ish to me. And I think somehow watching one of these stories in color would make that story feel fresh for that moment. And I don't mean to, like, period and stay that way. I just mean for that moment, it would give it that new flavor and something new to make my eyes want to stay and pay attention to it. And then, you know, going back to the black and white again, I don't see that as a problem because I don't sit here now and watch Three Stooges episodes and wish that they were all in color the way I'd seen those few. I just know that I enjoyed those few for that little effect to see those guys and those settings in, you know, and it's not 3D. It's horrible not to find a better word for it. But just like I said, just a more depth of field and more clarity. It's very interesting. But at the same time, with the new series episode telling one in black and white, you would get that same feeling, but in reverse. It would actually be an interesting experiment, actually, if they made a new series episode of Doctor Who where you could watch it in black and white or color if you wanted to. We're trying to go for an old school monster feel where we're doing this cinematic, here it is in black and white. But if you're a person that doesn't quite like black and white films, and there are some people I know who just can't sit through them, you know, which I don't get, but, you know, they can't sit through them for whatever reasoning, you can get that option. And it would be great, actually, for fans of the show to actually have those two differences. Two ways to enjoy that show, essentially. Even taking it a step further, if they shot one in film noir style, but they shot the same episode in another kind of more updated style, so they actually filmed it twice. They didn't just colorize or decolorize. They gave you two different versions of the same story to enjoy. I think that might be a fun thing. I'm sure the BBC would think of it as a waste of money, but I think it would be fun.
Okay. I think we've probably, you know, if they did do this, they've got the right star, haven't they? Because there was that video that came along a couple of weeks ago of Peter Capaldi talking about one of the art movements. It was surrealism, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So he's clearly a man who's into, you know, a more artistic side of cinema. And he's made plenty of his own films as well.
Well, interesting. I was just trying to think of, you know, when you said new series ones that you could put into black and white. My first thought was Human Nature, but then actually Human Nature works quite well. It'd be good to do a story which doesn't carry much strength or isn't generally considered to have much strength, which could perhaps be better, made better by being black and white. I think Human Nature works either way. But I was thinking Evolution of the Daleks and, you know, Manhattan, Daleks in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. If that was all in black and white.
It feels black and white, actually, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it?
I was just going to say it's a good era for it to have been black and white.
Yeah.
I think that would be a very strong one, and I think that would up its... it would give it a little extra sinisterness as well, especially the tunnels. And even the pigmen, I think, would work with a better... Mm. With that sort of dark-like contrast.
Yeah, add a bit of an RKO grain to it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be a fantastic one to do a black and white version of. So,
you know, Victory of the Daleks may have even been a good one for that. It might have helped that one.
Yeah, more of a British, sort of like slightly muted grey tone, or maybe moving more towards sepia.
Yeah, something. And it's like crackle. I'm thinking of two shots specifically. Actually, I'm thinking of the robot reveal of the scientist. I've forgotten his name, that has the bronze chest pieces. For some reason, I think that looks very old fashioned sci-fi, despite being very modern. But I also think obviously the space battle would fit somehow the black and white feel.
Well, I think even the even the Dalek ship, which as we know was done on quite a low budget, would probably look quite good in black. Would look better in black and white. It would have to. Yes.
It couldn't look worse, would it?
No. So maybe that one, as a desperate hope and attempt, would be worth trying. But yeah, I think I would stick for Evolution of the Daleks in Manhattan. I think that serious story isn't as bad as people like to try and make it out to be, and it might just elevate it a little better, give a bit more class.
So going back to the original suggestion, is there any classic cereal that you'd like to see colorized or not? You can have not if you want, but if there is one, tell me.
Right, okay. So we're talking about sort of like more Hartnell.
Hartnell-Charlton, yeah. Lost or found? Or never lost?
To be honest, I can't really think of one that I think would be made better through colour, because the production, I think, would look worse for it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, the only one I can think of, and that's purely down to its scope, I think, is the Master Plan.
Right,
and that's maybe because of the work Rick did on the graphic novel, Rick Lundy did on the graphic novel, and you know, turning those guys, that, you know, the League of Monsters, doing such a good job on them and like, bringing the planet to life. I can't think of any other reason, and I can't think of any other serial either. Brian?
No, I can't.
Well, see, this is a bit tough for me because I've got a point I'll make with it, but. First of all, I think you could take any story from the classic era, black and white era, and colorize them and get an interesting effect. And I think like certain stories have behind the scenes photos that you can draw on for the colors, and certain ones you can either try and match the colorful era or you just colorize it to try and make it look the best that it could, you know, where you're not drowning it with color, you're just making it in color. I think certain stories that really could benefit from a very colorful kind of aspect would be The Mind Robber. Because that would be a story that you know, mm-hmm. definitely could benefit from being trippy in color, kind of like a Wizard of Oz kind of feel.
Yep.
But where I was going to go with my point is technically, in a sense, we already saw two stories colorized because we saw the Peter Cushing films. And those two stories, I have to say, every time I watch the first Peter Cushing film, I love the visuals of that story, of the characters, of the city, everything. And it makes me think, what the actual televised version of the Daleks could have been like in color. And I think it's just a good base to show us that these things can already look good in color because they were the same era. And, you know, if you use those same kind of color palettes, you can get a very nice piece in color, I think.
Okay.
Okay. Mm. I thought one, War Machines, I think would be, in a sort of contrary way that we sort of say that Pertwee's era would look good in black and white, but Pertwee's era is predominantly unit. I think it'd be kind of interesting for things like the War Machines and maybe even Invasion to be done in color for the counter reasons to see sort of the Earth-based unity stories. I know War Machines isn't technically done in a colorized version could be quite interesting. And there would be little damage in War Machines. I don't think there's not any really bad sets or effects that I think you would really find ruins the effect if it was colorized.
Yeah, well, I think I want to watch the War Machines again. I really enjoyed that last time I watched it.
I didn't, and I think I'd like to watch it again just because maybe I would enjoy it again now I feel a little more familiar with it and have no high expectations.
Although, of course, there's the Jimmy Savile reference.
Well, we can't block out everything.
No, we can't.
Jimmy Savile, and it can be. I mean, it's no. About the entire collection of Jim Will Fix It I have on my shelf. Which I don't, because I hated that show. I loathed that show as a kid. It just absolutely, I hated it. And that's, you know, before we taking aside the legacy and everything. At the time, I just loathed it. It felt like such cheap patronizing pap. And that was as a child. You know.
You had high sensibilities to me. Though, to be honest with you, I was probably more interested in the magic chair.
Well, I mean, as a child, you know, I wanted people to fix it so they could fly. And when they could fly, I didn't mean be put onto wires.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Like put in front of a screen, which is what they would do. You know, it was the cheapness of the show which just sort of got me. It didn't realise what I wanted. Yes. But yeah, anyway. Okay. So, yeah.
Well, we will move on to our recommendations then. And I think this week we'll start with Mr. Terranova.
I don't even remember if I recommended this last time. Did I say I was watching The Key to Time again, one of these
Not
podcasts?
Last week. Not last
week. Well, I was. I am. Can't recall if I did that. But anyway,
the Reebok operation or the Reebok operation?
Yeah. Yes, I highly recommend the Reebok operation. Please check that out on my Facebook page. I decided I wanted to watch some because obviously making that comic strip got me in the mood for it. And there are certain stories within there that I watch more than others because there are certain ones that are better than others within it. And I realized that I kind of watched The Androids of Tara very little for some reason. So I watched that, and it's really enjoyable. I really like it. There's a lot of good stuff that happened in it. So I would recommend the whole season of The Key to Time, of course, because it's fun. And the one thing that actually got me was for a TV show of the era, or for a series of the era where they're going on this journey, it would have been very easy for them in every episode to go, okay, we have to find this item. And at the end of every story, go, okay, we found it. Let's transform it. Okay, we've got it. We've achieved this goal. It was rewatching it recently that I realized how many times they didn't do that. In the first episode, they achieved their goal at the end of the episode. Fine. In the second episode, in the first episode, yes, they do. In the second episode, they don't get their item. They wait till the beginning of the very next story to show you, yes, we actually did finally pick up that piece. And I thought, this is interesting. They're kind of making the pieces just kind of do what the TARDIS used to do, which is what brings them to the story. And I think that's very interesting. Rather than make it be like the whole crux of the story, they're just kind of replacing the TARDIS with something else for this season. And I thought that was, I don't know, I found that a very interesting technique. So yeah, I'd recommend that.
Interesting fact about the Androids of Tara, Peter Jeffrey, who played Count Grendel, was supposedly offered the role of the Second Doctor.
Really?
Before Patrick Charlton, yeah.
Don't know if I can see that.
Well, you don't
well,
have
you
to.
Can't.
Didn't
no.
happen.
Didn't happen.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I have, you know, I just have this vision, I guess, of him. I really only know him, at least by name, certainly from that. I can't remember if I've seen him in anything else, but I can't.
But he did a lot of lot of things, and he wasn't. I mean, I barely recognized him. I was watching something else with him in not so long ago, so I checked out who it was, and it was him. Because I was like watching it, I know who this guy is, but I can't quite place him. Who is he? And that's who it turned out to be.
Huh.
So he's a very very good character actor. If you can fool me, I can tell you. Okay, James, shall I go first?
You go first.
Me, okay. I have been watching a couple of things and reading. Okay, so I've watched Iron Man 3 this week.
Yep.
I'm not sure if there's any discernible Doctor Who link. Guy Pearce was born in England. That's as close as I can get. And Ben Kingsley's in it as well, who's from Scarborough, which is just down the road from here. So I'm struggling, I know. Ben Kingsley, never been in Doctor Who, bit of a surprise perhaps. Really, really enjoyed it. Was much better than I was expecting. I think perhaps although I enjoyed the second one, I don't think it was as good as it could have been. So
I enjoyed the end montage of that film.
The third one?
The end montage, yeah. The funky music tractor. Yeah. I got that on my iPlayer, on my iPod thing.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so I enjoyed that. Very, very good film. Looks like it's closing the series, but who knows what they will do later on. And also, speaking of Marvel-related things, although it's not a Marvel comic, although it's based firmly in the Marvel universe that was created for its original run, I've been reading All Hail Megatron, which is sort of Generation 1 Transformers. I think it came out in 2009. I got the first 3-4 issues, and I haven't finished it yet as a result, but it's really good. Really surprised by how that's developing. And a slightly unusual recommendation is if you're a fan of the Beatles or Led Zeppelin or neither or both, there's this mashup by a guy called Soundhog, which has been pulled from YouTube, but you can still find it in a few places, of A Whole Lot of Love and Helter Skelter from the White Album. And it's the most remarkable mashup ever. It sounds absolutely phenomenal. And it's now my ringtone. That's how good it is. And it was actually, I hate to name drop, as the fourth Doctor might say, I got it from John Guiler. So that's very cool. In fact, I should have got John Guiler on just to say I hate to name drop. But there you go.
Yes, you should have, yes.
Yes, that would have been funny. So that's really cool. And I hope to have more things to recommend next time. James.
Let's have a look. Non-Doctor Who stuff, as I mentioned in this very podcast, 20th Century Boys, which is a remake of the manga, very popular Japanese manga, which is a very good little bit of epic storytelling. Very big over there. interesting narrative devices. I think if you're looking for something fresh and new on the superhero sci-fi front, it's worth a look. I would say that. I've been enjoying the football. Have you been enjoying the football? Have you been watching it?
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
I've enjoyed some of it. Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed Spain and Holland. And that's probably about it.
No, I've been watching. I've just been enjoying the run generally, just been watching each one. So that's been taking up some of my time. So it's like two games a night at the moment. So
But I've watched more than I can recall, to be honest with you.
Let's have a look. I would like to say I've been watching some of the Doctor Who celebrations videos on Doctor Who.tv, which if you've not actually checked out, there's some very nice, like, you know, half hour videos of them talking. And there's a very nice one of the four of them with Tom, Peter, Sylvester and Colin chatting to Nick Briggs, which is well worth a look. I will make sure that Christian's got the link. And there's another good one with Coleman, Smith and Moffat chatting just straight after the 50th Day of the Doctor aired. And again, that's quite a nice little chat over Doctor Who. So I think I'd like to recommend that. And of course, as I said, the X-Men Days of our Future Past is a very good movie. Again, it's nice. We're getting a couple of movies occasionally now in the superhero genre, which just take away from the standard trope of superhero movies, where you have an origin, a villain origin, a montage where things go wrong at the end, in the halfway through, and then the big battle at the end. You're getting things like Days of Future Past. You're getting things like Dread last year as well. Mm-hmm. Things which just break the mold a little bit. I hope we get to see more of the Avengers, obviously, as well, which I've not seen, but apparently does similar sort of things. So break the mold of the dull Man of Steel, Dark Knight Rises, you know.
Well, let's have a quick straw poll before we finish.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to have to stick to Marvel because they're the only one who's strung together. Their universe is the only one that's strung together as any series. Which do you think is the best superhero Marvel universe series?
As in a series?
Of the movies.
Of the movies.
Yes.
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, I think the Iron Man 3 are very good. More to do with Downey Jr. just being a very charming actor. The Marvel movies, I mean, we know we're getting off point, I think are very smart in the sense that they hit and miss on the basis that they find very good, charming leads. Tobey Maguire was a very good lead for Peter Parker, not because he was very much like Peter Parker, which he probably is, but because he is a very charming actor. Same with Robert Downey Jr. sort of carrying Iron Man. You start to, if you get the bad leads, you sort of get the sort of slightly naff films, I think. So I think Iron Man 3, I like the X-Men lot, even though obviously there are some, X-Men 2 was too long, X-Men 3 had mistakes in it. But, you know, I loved the original X-Men movie. I liked the Wolverine movies, shock horror, even though the second one does trend very highly on Japanese stereotypes to a slightly uncomfortable level. You know, got a samurai in there, check, you know, Japanese mafias, check, issues about the bomb, check, you know, and all the standard tropes are in there, but it still worked quite nicely.
Okay. Brian?
And I really like this one.
While I am enjoying the Marvel series, I've always been more of a Marvel guy than a DC guy. I don't know. I think for me, it comes down to, like, I don't see the issues quite as much as most people saw with Iron Man 2 or even 3. While Iron Man 3, I would have labeled the weaker one of the two, in my opinion. I really have to say that I think out of everything that they've put out, that I really have enjoyed the Iron Man series and the new Amazing Spider-Man series. They're the two that are tops for me. They nailed it with the casting and their storytelling, I think, and I've thoroughly enjoyed and watched those tons of times already, and it's very hard for me to pick between those two, because as James was saying, it really does come down to really strong leads, and I think both Andrew Garfield and Robert Downey Jr. have just nailed the roles there, as well as the people around them. But I don't know. I can't pick between them. I have to say those two. I think they're just the two strongest ones they have right now.
I've not watched any new Spider-Man, the two ones. I mean, I'd have to say, because I haven't watched those, I'm still very pro the first three Spider-Man. And yes, I know the third one was a mess. Yeah. I think they made massive mistakes in... funnily enough, it's one of the few times I would say that the studio was right and the creative team was wrong, and they should have gone with Venom for the third movie, because I think he carried a different trend and flavor and character intimacy to the films that would have made it different from the second one. The idea of going with Sandman is one of those Golden Age villains, which is no different to any of the other Golden Age villains.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of thing. So I think they made a mistake and then ended up with this mishmash of two ideas that
well,
just didn't
exactly
work.
Yeah.
But I mean, Spider-Man 2, I think is, while a little over long again, has some fantastically great superhero moments in it as well. So I do think generally, I mean, while DC have done some good stuff in the fact that I think Burton's original Batman was brilliant, I thought Dark Knight Returns was brilliant. By and large, their stuff, I don't think they find the right castings for them as well. As, I mean, you know, George Clooney and whoever that guy was, a Man of Steel. And
I do have to agree with the Spider-Man series that the original Tobey Maguire and Sam Raimi films, they were enjoyable. And, you know, they were the first proper live-action films that we had gotten that gave it a real proper go or real proper, chance that it deserved on screen. But ever since even the first film, I had issues with those films for many reasons, being a Spider-Man fan since as far back as my memory has memory. In all honesty, like, I just, you know, he's always been my number one, and they changed too many things. And, you know, I won't go into detail now because I want to get to Christian's point of view here. But what I will say is that, in my opinion, the Andrew Garfield series fixed those things that I felt were wrong in the Tobey Maguire series. Now, that's not discounting the Tobey Maguire series, because I think Alfred Molina and Willem Dafoe were brilliant at mm-hmm. the Goblin and Doc Ock. And I think there were lots of things to enjoy in that original Spider-Man series. But I just think the new one is topping it so far, and I hope that they continue to do so.
Okay, I'm torn between X-Men and Iron Man. I'm edging towards Iron Man at the moment, but then I haven't watched Days of Future Past yet, which may occur later this week.
I think you'll enjoy it. I mean, I've got a lot of love now for James McAvoy. I think he does a great job, and he was good in the soccer aid this year as well. I watched him in that, which was, it was pretty cool.
Right, I missed that. What was the score?
I'm trying to remember, the rest of the world won, which was unusual. I'm trying to remember what the score was. Was it just simply 1-0? No, they didn't. Was it 2-1? It was, right. They did.
Did the rest of the world win, though?
Yes, they did.
The rest of the world was captained by Martin, Michael Sheen, wasn't it?
Yes.
That's our Doctor Who link, dear listener.
It was a more interesting team, I think, when you've got him, and you've got, what's his name, from the Three Musketeers was in there as well, who was pretty cool.
The Spanish guy?
Yeah.
The one that was in Heroes?
Yes.
Right, okay.
So there's a few cool
Matt
ones.
Smith was originally signed up for that.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, I think he's making a film about metal men, though.
Why?
That's why he didn't appear in it.
Oh, dear me. Dear me, Mr. Matt Smith. Oh, that's disappointing. Also recommending, as usual, Legacy, I still think is very strong.
Yes, there's an article on Casterbus.
There is.
And there's a link to a piece on the Doctor Who Legacy homepage by the creative developer.
That webpage, my computer and my phone has issues with it.
Yes, I think it's not a great webpage. But if you read it, you'll get surprised at the end. So you need to read that.
I missed the Pertwee code this weekend. I was annoyed about that.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I didn't read about that. I didn't see it on Casterbus being mentioned as well, so I blame you.
Okay, I didn't know about it.
Oh, well, there was no excuse. but yes, no, it's a good game. If you still haven't downloaded it, really do support, because they really are very dedicated to that game, and it's worth the support.
Okay, right. So that does bring us to the end of this week's Castover's podcast with a K. I'd like to thank James and Brian for a great pair of chats. And
what are you going to say then? A great pair of chaps, yes.
And chats. No, great pair of chats.
Chats.
Chatting, chats.
Chats.
And James's butler for his amusing doodles.
Oh, absolutely.
And we'll be back.
Oh, now he draws the penis.
Oh. We will be back in some configuration of ourselves next time. Bye-bye.